these, you know, big, big anchor men of the media, you know, these journalists and, you know, academics and God knows what. They're all in front, and they're like kids. They're like 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds. They're fumbling about. They don't know what to do. And each and every one of them comes back and says, that man is God. You know, what is this? You know, it's like, you know, he's a representation of God on earth. You know, what can we say? You know, he's like something out of the prophets. Look,
whatever they said, the point is, it was undeniable.
It was undeniable, that's the thing.
And of course, his enemies talked about this. It's not even that, you know, the people who liked him.
As we said about Henri Kissinger, you know, he said he's doing things that we can't understand.
Okay.
He talks about jihad, and he talks about heaven and martyrdom and God. And right. What's that got to do with global policy and, you know, foreign relations? And
this is the point. Rely on God.
Exactly.
Trust in God's power if you are connected to God. And believe me, even if you're a sinner.
Even if you're a sinner, that's right.
Okay.
Yes.
This is even if you're a sinner.
Yes, of course we are.
Because Allah's mercy is, you know, has no limit.
Yeah, it's open to all.
So if you sincerely and, you know, with a feeling of, and with this idea that, and this attitude that you go to God and you say, listen, I know I'm a sinner.
Yes. Exactly. Okay. Confess your all.
You know, I'm not, I have nothing, you know, to show for.
Show for it.
Yeah. All I need is your mercy. And your support.
Sure.
You think Allah is not going to support you? You think Allah is not going to support you? Of course He's going to support you.
Of course He promised He would.
Okay? So what I'm trying to say here, that this is feasible. This is reality. It's not some pie in the sky.
No, it's not.
Okay? Again, I repeat, they keep saying, oh, well, he was a very strong person. Why would he? Well, we don't have the capacity. We'll raise your capacity.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the whole point of life, is to raise your capacity.
You remind me now of this Egyptian correspondent. What's his name? He was...
Hassanain, Haikal.
Haikal, thank you.
Yeah, no, he's more than a journalist. He's like an intellectual.
Intellectual. Right. And he said, I asked the question to the Imam. You know, he's sitting in this small room. There's only one part of the wall is wallpaper. That's the part they asked the Imam, just please sit there so we can take a nice picture of you on the camera. I'm sure that's the only reason why they put him on that particular position. All these guys, and as you say, this big intellectual is sitting there, and he says, I asked the Imam about, you know, the running of the affairs of state, the economy, and all that sort of thing. And the Imam comes back and says, read Imam Ali. Read Najal Balagha. And he said, I came back with 3 khutbahs of Imam Ali. And only Ali was swimming around in my head and nothing else.
Exactly.
So there we go.
Exactly. You have the famous instructions to Malik Ashraf. We've mentioned this many times in different programs.
Sure.
And this is the point.
Yeah.
The point is that Islam, what is the central message of Islam? It's rely on God.
God, exactly.
Trust in God. Okay, now they have that on the dollar, in God we trust.
Yes, yes.
But they don't.
They don't.
Okay.
No, in trust is the opposite.
Right.
It's Satan.
They're pharaohs.
Yes. They can't say that, we trust Satan.
Right.
They can't say that. It doesn't sound good on the back
actually,
of a green
Satan
bag.
Will always come with through the door
of God. It doesn't look right, you know. I trust Iblis on the back of the greenback. I can't see that happening. You know, God, I mean, God's good.
Right. No, who's going to deny that?
Who's going to deny that? You see, this is the problem. But you're right. You're right.
It has to do with really doing it, not just mouthing the words.
Yeah,
and then, you know.
Sure.
Trying to, you know, outmaneuver the stock market in order to, you know, make a living.
Exactly.
You have to trust God, even in difficult times.
Of
I mean, the point is in difficult times.
In difficult times, that's the point. Right? In
when
hardship.
When you've overthrown, you know, the peacock throne and...
Yes, exactly.
And the whole world is going against
you.
And they're like, hey, we're going to bomb you, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. You're like, hey... You know, America hech kalati
nahi. In God we trust.
No, he says, America can't do a damn thing.
Can't do a damn thing, exactly.
So, this is the lesson from Imam. As the other things we discussed about this great man, every aspect of what we saw in him, and we saw him.
Sure.
This is not something that
we saw him.
You know, Alhamdulillah, this was one of the great blessings in our life. Allah allowed us to see him. It was all lessons. And they've stayed with us, and inshallah they will stay with us for the rest of our lives, and we have to pass them on.
Sure.
We don't have an excuse on the Day of Judgment.
Exactly. Thank you. On that note, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I thank you very much for that enlightening discussion. I hope our listeners benefited from it. Of course, the Imam is a lesson for all times until the Day of Judgment, and we must take stock of his wisdom. But I thank our listeners and just have to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. New accounts show that former President Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in plans developed by outside advisors to use national security agencies to seek evidence of fraud. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Maggie Haberman, Michael Schmidt, and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Trump Had Role in Weighing Proposals to Seize Voting Machines. Six weeks after Election Day, with his hold on power slipping, President Donald J. Trump directed his lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, to make a remarkable call. Donald Trump wanted him to ask the Department of Homeland Security if it could legally take control of voting machines in key swing states, three people familiar with the matter said. Rudy Giuliani did so, calling the department's acting deputy secretary, who said he lacked the authority to audit or impound the voting machines. Donald Trump pressed Rudolph Giuliani to make that inquiry after rejecting a separate effort by his outside advisors to have the Pentagon take control of the machines. And the outreach to the Department of Homeland Security came not long after Donald Trump, in an Oval Office meeting with Attorney General William Barr, raised the possibility of whether the Justice Department could seize the voting machines, a previously undisclosed suggestion that William Barr immediately shot down. The new accounts show that Donald Trump was more directly involved than previously known in exploring proposals to use his national security agencies to seize voting machines as he grasped unsuccessfully for evidence of fraud that would help him reverse his defeat in the 2020 presidential election, according to people familiar with the episodes. The existence of proposals to use at least three federal departments to assist Donald Trump's attempt to stay in power has been publicly known. The proposals involving the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security were codified by advisors in the form of draft executive orders. But the new accounts provide fresh insight into how the former president considered and to some degree pushed the plans, which would have taken the United States into uncharted territory by using federal authority to seize control of the voting systems run by states on baseless grounds of widespread voting fraud. The people familiar with the matter were briefed on the events by participants or had first-hand knowledge of them. The accounts about the voting machines emerged after a weekend when Donald Trump declared at a rally in Texas that he might pardon people charged in connection with the storming of the Capitol last 6th of January if he were re-elected. In a statement issued after the rally, Donald Trump also suggested that his Vice President Mike Pence could have personally overturned the election by refusing to count delegates to the Electoral College who had vowed to cast their votes for Joseph R. Biden Jr. The new information helps to flesh out how the draft executive orders to seize voting machines came into existence and points in particular to the key role played by a retired Army colonel named Phil Waldron. According to people familiar with the accounts, Phil Waldron, shortly after the election, began telling associates that he had found irregularities in vote results that he felt were suggestive of fraud. He then came up with the idea of having a federal agency like the military or the Department of Homeland Security confiscate the voting machines to preserve evidence. Phil Waldron first proposed the notion of the Pentagon's involvement to Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, whom he says he served with in the Defense Intelligence Agency. The plans were among an array of options that were placed before Donald Trump in the tumultuous days and weeks that followed the election. Developed by an ad hoc group of lawyers like Sidney Powell and other allies including Michael Flynn and Phil Waldron, the group often found itself at odds with Rudy Giuliani and his longtime associate Bernard Kerik, as well as with Donald Trump's White House counsel Pat Cipollone and his team. Around the same time that Donald Trump brought up the possibility of having the Justice Department seize the voting machines, for example, he also tried to persuade state lawmakers in contested states like Michigan and Pennsylvania to use local law enforcement agencies to take control of them. People familiar with the matter have confirmed. The state lawmakers refused to go along with the plan. The meeting with William Barr took place in mid to late November, when Donald Trump raised the idea of whether the Justice Department could be used to seize voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. Donald Trump told William Barr that his lawyers had told him that the department had the power to seize voting machines as evidence of fraud. Donald Trump mentioned a specific state that had used machines built by Dominion Voting Systems where his lawyers believed there had been fraud, although it is unclear which state Donald Trump was referring to. William Barr, who had been briefed extensively at that point by federal law enforcement officials about how the theories being pushed by Donald Trump's legal team about the Dominion voting machines were unfounded, told Trump that the Justice Department had no basis for seizing the voting machines because there was no probable cause to believe a crime had been committed. It was only after several early options were exhausted that Phil Waldron pitched the idea of using other parts of the federal government to seize the machines to both Rudolph Giuliani and members of the Trump legal team, and also to Michael Flynn and his own associates, including Sidney Powell and Patrick Byrne, a wealthy business executive who funded many of the efforts to challenge the election. Phil Waldron, who owns a bar and distillery outside Austin, Texas, was previously best known for having circulated a 38-page PowerPoint presentation to lawmakers and White House aides that was filled with extreme plans to overturn the election. Rudolph Giuliani was vehemently opposed to the idea of the military taking part in the seizure of voting machines, according to two people familiar with the matter. The conflict between him and his legal team and Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, and Patrick Byrne came to a dramatic head on 18th of December 2020 during a meeting with Donald Trump in the Oval Office at the White House. At that meeting, Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell presented Donald Trump with a copy of the draft executive order authorizing the military to oversee the seizure of machines. After reading it, Donald Trump summoned Rudolph Giuliani to the Oval Office, according to one person familiar with the matter. When Rudy Giuliani read the draft order, he told Donald Trump that the military could be used only if there was clear-cut evidence of foreign interference in the U.S. presidential election. Sidney Powell, who had spent the past month filing lawsuits claiming that China and other countries had hacked into voting machines, said she had such evidence, the person said. But Rudy Giuliani was adamant that the military should not be mobilized, the person said, and Donald Trump ultimately heeded his advice. Shortly after the Oval Office meeting, Phil Waldron amended the draft executive order suggesting that if the U.S. Defense Department could not oversee the seizure of machines, then the Department of Homeland Security could, the person said. Around that time, Donald Trump asked Rudy Giuliani to call Kenneth Cusinelli, the acting deputy secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, to ask about the viability of the proposal, according to two people familiar with the matter. Kenneth Cusinelli said that Homeland Security officials could not take part in the plan. All of this was playing out amid open acrimony among White House aides and outside advisors about how best and how far to proceed with efforts to pursue Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud in the election. That same month, during a meeting on another matter, Donald Trump asked Kenneth Cusinelli what he thought of appointing a special counsel to investigate election fraud. Mr. Cusinelli, according to two people briefed on the conversation, said it was not a good idea for a variety of reasons. When Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, and Patrick Byrne arrived at the White House to discuss their plan to use the military to seize voting machines, they were not let into the Oval Office by a typical gatekeeper like Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff. Rather, they were escorted in by Garrett Ziegler, a young aide to another Trump advisor, Peter Navarro, according to Mr. Ziegler's account. I waved in General Flynn and Sidney Powell on the Friday night of the 18th, for which Mark Meadows' office revoked my guest privileges, Mr. Ziegler said on a podcast, adding that he had done so because he was frustrated with the current counsel that Donald Trump was getting. Even Rudy Giuliani, who had spent weeks peddling some of the most outrageous claims about election fraud, felt that the idea of bringing in the military was beyond the pale. After Michael Flynn and Sidney Powell left the Oval Office, according to a person familiar with the matter, Rudy Giuliani predicted that the plans they were proposing were going to get Donald Trump impeached.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, and Iceland.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In January 2017, a Canadian man fatally shot six worshippers at the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center and seriously injured 19 others. Over the past 5 years, Muslim community members have pushed decision makers at all levels to denounce Islamophobia and put concrete measures in place to curb incitement and hate-filled violence, including through stricter gun control laws. Also, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who immediately called the killings a terrorist attack on Muslims, has since faced criticism and calls to do more to stem Islamophobia. Those demands grew louder in the aftermath of a string of hate-filled incidents, including an attack that left four members of a Muslim family dead in London, Ontario, last June. Also, in another hate crime incident, Canada's deadliest vehicle ramming attack happened in 2018, when a man plowed his van into a group of pedestrians in Toronto, killing 10 people. On Friday, the federal government announced in a statement that it intends to appoint a special representative to combat Islamophobia in Canada. But how effective would that be? Muslim Canadians are facing a sharp increase in violent hate crimes in public places and in places of work and worship. One example is the murder of Muhammad Aslim Zafis, who was killed outside a Toronto mosque in September 2020. Most recently, black Muslim women have also been disproportionately targeted by Islamophobic street harassment and assaults, particularly in Alberta. A report says in the last 5 years, more Muslims have been killed in targeted hate attacks in Canada than in any other G7 country. Also, over the past decade, police-reported hate crimes against Muslims in Canada have risen from 45 in 2012 to 181 in 2018. Now, on the fifth anniversary of the Quebec mosque shooting and the National Day of Action Against Islamophobia on January 29th, around a dozen Canadian Muslims are speaking out about experiences of Islamophobia in a new report from the charity Islamic Relief Canada. According to the report, many of those who've shared their experiences felt they were to be expected, living as a minority in Canada. The report also found that more women tended to be the targets of Islamophobia. A report by the National Council of Canadian Muslims stated that Muslims living in Canada have been increasingly facing anti-Muslim sentiments since the 9/11 attacks happened 2 decades ago in the US. The advocacy organization said Islamophobia is systemic in Canada and is evolving. The hate increased in the years immediately following the World Trade Center attack and has slowly grown since, with Statistics Canada reporting that anti-Muslim attacks numbered 99 in 2014, up from 36 in 2009. In 2015, hate crimes ballooned to 159, a 60% jump, and in 2017, incidents showed a dramatic increase to 349. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Saturday said that Islamophobia is not acceptable at any cost and vowed to make his country safer for Muslims. But how successful has Trudeau been as a leader to address systemic Islamophobia as a major priority in Canada? Human rights advocates have criticized Trudeau's government for failing to meet its promise to deliver legislation to address hate crimes against minorities.
Now, the point is this, that this actually is not just as a result of 9/11. The level of Islamophobia around the world was actually very high even before 9/11.
Justin Trudeau had said while he is deeply opposed to Bill 21, which bars a range of public servants in roles of authority, including teachers, from wearing visible religious symbols, his government won't step into the legal challenge taking place in Quebec to avoid triggering a fight with the province over jurisdiction. In December 2021, an elementary school teacher in Quebec was told she could no longer teach in class because she wears a hijab, which is prohibited under Bill 21. That marks another failure for Trudeau as he falls short of condemning the bigotry against Muslims wearing symbols of their faith in his home province. Jeddah is the second largest city in Saudi Arabia and is home to 4.5 million people. Since late October, at least a million people in Jeddah have had their lives turned upside down amid a large-scale demolition push by the government. Residents say the demolitions have taken them by surprise and given them little to no room to plan their relocation because it was on short notice. The displacement has caused a housing crisis, with rental prices skyrocketing across the city. In some cases, rents have doubled in a matter of days and many aren't able to afford them. At least 10 neighborhoods have been completely wiped out so far, as work continues in around another 10 areas. The plan targets some 60 districts, mostly located in the city's southern part, and is expected to continue for months. Online footage and satellite images showed the wide-scale destruction of entire neighborhoods, which have been turned into dust. In 2020, similar demolitions carried out in the northern Tabuk province made international headlines. Saudi Arabia's Al-Huwaitat tribe sent an urgent communication to the United Nations, calling for an investigation into allegations of forced displacement and abuse by Saudi authorities. Their request came after months of alleged harassment, arrests, and abductions by the Saudi forces, apparently due to the tribe's refusal to relocate to facilitate the government's NEOM megacity project. Also, Saudi security forces killed an Al-Huwaitat tribe member, Abdul Rahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al-Huwaiti, who was an activist protesting his eviction. He had also denounced the NEOM project on several occasions. At least 20,000 members of the tribe now face eviction due to the project, with no information about where they will live in the future.
And they've even destroyed most of the religious monuments of people, like the Prophet, peace upon him, and his household. So this just bulldozing history and bulldozing tradition is really in their blood. So I'm not that surprised that they're doing this kind of nuclear scale urban renewal, so-called project in Jeddah.
The Saudi Crown Prince's desert dream, NEOM, is due to completion in 2025 on Tabuk's Red Sea coast. It's a city designed to attract international investors, but has been subject to scrutiny since it was announced in 2017, with critics calling it wasteful and inefficient in addressing the problems of the Saudi economy, including unemployment and dependence on oil. Currently, over 11% of Saudi citizens are unemployed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's oil sector still contributes up to 80% of the country's budget revenues, while 88% of Saudi Arabia's foreign income is from oil exports. Details of the NEOM project prompted a flurry of reactions when it was first announced, as people accused Mohammed bin Salman of using extravagant technology to cover up the kingdom's human rights abuses. Ever since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has ramped up arrests of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others perceived as political opponents, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnations of the crackdown. The destruction of communities on the NEOM side follows decades of tensions between the House of Saud and the tribes it has ruled over since the creation of the Saudi state in 1932. Exerting control over the land through construction projects or destruction of some heritage sites have marked this rule. In 2017, the UN condemned the kingdom's forced demolition of the walled city of Awamiya in the eastern Katif region as violating human rights.
The United States military has come under intense scrutiny over its procedures to guard against civilian casualties after a high-profile mistaken drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, has claimed the lives of 10 civilians, including 7 children, on August 29. The U.S. military initially said it successfully targeted a Daesh terrorist who was linked to the attack on the Kabul airport that killed over 100 people, including 13 U.S. troops. The latest study by the RAND Corporation think tank concluded that systemic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were resulting in it falling short of its duties on civilian casualties. It added that in conflicts, the U.S. military's access to targeted areas is limited both before and after strikes, and it relies on intelligence gathered remotely using sources like drone surveillance and satellite imagery.
Well, the United States regularly violates its own and international laws about related to war, but I do think the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its use of drones entirely. We know because of brave whistleblowers like Daniel Hale and other journalists who have reported on drones and drone use that the U.S. often uses faulty intelligence to conduct these strikes, which do result in lots of civilian casualties.
The RAND study, which was required by congressional legislation, found that the problem is compounded by the U.S. military when it fails to adequately talk to people from outside the U.S. government or armed forces who might have access to information on the ground. After the RAND study was released, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a memorandum calling for the creation of a plan on civilian harm mitigation and response in the months to come, as well as the creation of Civilian Protection Center later this year. A senior Pentagon official later admitted that the department's data gathering strategy has been faulty and expressed the need to incorporate the figures from other sources in American tallies. The U.S. runs nearly 700 overseas military bases in at least 80 countries around the world. Such widespread military presence means that Washington has been involved in many wars, either covertly or overtly, to secure its interests. Those wars almost always result in many civilian casualties. The question is how the U.S. is planning to reduce the number of civilians who pay the cost of the war on their country with their lives.
Yeah, I think for many reasons the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its foreign policy. We need to move away from war first and foremost because of the impact it has internationally on countries like Yemen and Afghanistan and other countries the U.S. has been involved in a war inside of in the last few years. Also, the environmental impact of war. War and militarism is driving the climate crisis. And also, we need to do things in the United States, like cut the Pentagon budget to move us away from war and put more money towards things that actually matter, like free healthcare for all Americans and that sort of thing.
That being said, the simplest solution to the problem of civilian casualties overseas seems to be not conducting any such operations in the first place, as the U.S. military's track record in accepting accountability is far from acceptable, and at the same time, the countries where the U.S. has deployed troops in are calling for their withdrawal.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists use explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasakah was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasakah this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say, we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when, I mean, that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism. But in reality, it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasakah require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halt its support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Bahizi, 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 Ey shahidon rahe khuda, Ey karde, Bahre ehyay haq jun fada, Kas patre, قطره خون پاک شما می روید تا ابد در وطن ناله ها برخیزی 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 برخیزی
بسم الله
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Remarks of the leader of the revolution about the 22nd of Bahman. After the passing away of Imam Khomeini and after his anniversary, this decade of Fajr must show that for the people, the memory of the Imam is as precious as the person of the Imam. Well, if it is decided that the memory of the Imam, like all ordinary memories, will gradually weaken, one day it will disappear. Know this. The day when we in this country do not have the memory of Imam Khomeini, the country will suffer a great loss. You should not let this happen. The memory of Imam, more than ever, is in the decade of Fajr and on the 22nd of Bahman. Even more than the anniversary of the passing away of Imam Khomeini, this commemoration shows his noble personality. This is in fact the birth of the Imamate of this country. In the same sense that the Imam and Islam themselves have drawn for us. Before that, Imam was the leader of the struggle and movement, but from the day he entered the country and formed the Islamic State, he became the Imam of the Islamic Ummah. This is more important than the memory of death.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Millions of Iranians across the country have begun 10 days of celebrations marking the anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that put an end to the monarchy of the Pahlavi regime in Iran. You are listening to IRIB English Radio and Ayatollah Khamenei's speech on this regard.
The marches of our dear people on different occasions of the revolution and most importantly on the 22nd of Bahman are like a rain of mercy that acquaints eyes and hearts with the brilliant truth of the revolution, manifests the greatness of the revolution and the great Imam, and brings hope and happiness to friends, and it brings frustration to the enemies. And I thank God Almighty for this great success and grace, thankful, and the people of Iran for this effort, determination and loyalty. The 22nd of Bahman, an anniversary that is not a dry formal ceremony. Compare the anniversaries of the revolutions, the anniversaries of the national days in the countries with this great movement of the people in our dear country. The anniversary of our revolution is not a dry and formal ceremony. It is 100% popular ceremony. People take part in the severe cold and the scorching heat in all circumstances, where they need to be on the scene, and on the 22nd of Bahman, every year, the people of this field are honored and enter the field and show their presence to all enemies and opponents. This can be seen in the world. The 22nd of Bahman and the 22nd of Bahman March are a manifestation of national authority. It is a manifestation of the authority of the Iranian nation. It is a manifestation of the presence of the people and the national will and determination of the Iranian nation that men, women, old and young, take to the streets in all circumstances and present themselves in front of the eyes of the spectators throughout the country. This is very great.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through.
Joseph Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Reza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemeni health workers have staged a demonstration inside the Ministry of Health in Yemen's capital Sana'a to warn that over 300 health facilities are on the verge of collapse due to the severe fuel shortage. They slammed the continued detention of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The health sector is suffering greatly due to the lack of fuel, as health officials suffer from a shortage in electrical power generations to save the lives of thousands of patients. Intensive care units, oxygen factories, operation rooms, emergency rooms, and other divisions will stop, and this is a crime against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community remains silent about what is happening. The United Nations has failed to fulfill its duties.
The Ministry of Health has called on the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels and save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients who may lose their lives as a result of the Saudi blockade on the country.
Banning the entry of fuel ships and piracy on Yemeni oil ships lead to a health catastrophe, as hospitals and health centers are in constant need of fuel. The interruption means that health services will stop working. Some patients come from other governorates to get treatment in Sana'a, such as cancer patients, and the fuel crisis will make their transportation even more difficult. Be warned of an imminent health disaster and call on the international community to do its part to save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children.
Recently, the member of Yemen's negotiating delegation, Abdul Malik al-Hajri, passed away of kidney failure as he could not travel abroad for treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a International Airport that comes as Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015.
The lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Unfortunately, the inaction of the international community towards the catastrophic situation in Yemen is emboldening the Saudi-led coalition to further continue its crimes in the war-ravaged country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. The two sides discussed bilateral relations and recent regional developments. During the talks, Assad referred to both countries' mutual understanding of regional issues, asserting that Arabs need to conduct realistic dialogue and set up necessary bases for political relations among each other. He stressed that developments in the Arab world require a change of their political approach. For his part, Busaidi conveyed to Assad greetings of the Omani Sultan, underlining Syria's strong and brave stances in facing regional challenges.
We look forward to strengthening our economic, trade and political relations. I discussed in detail such relations with my Syrian counterpart. There are efforts made by many countries currently to bring Arabs together, correct mistakes of the past, and adopt a more futuristic vision for Arab cooperation in order to overcome the past.
For his part, Syrian Foreign Minister underlined the significance of collaboration with Oman for bringing Arabs together.
The meeting was an opportunity to discuss joint Arab action and solidarity, as well as establishing the best relations among Arab states in order to correct previous mistakes and build the future. Syria and Oman formed together a force for underlining the importance of a united Arab stance to overcome challenges facing our countries and peoples.
Oman has been working for years on alleviating tension between Arab countries, mainly with regards to Syria. He arrived in Damascus coming from Kuwait, where Arab foreign ministers were meeting. The significance of Oman's strategy towards Syria is that it did not sever its ties, as many Arab countries did during the crisis. The visit comes as Arab countries are gradually restoring relations with Syria following the victory of the country's government against terror. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Israeli forces have escalated their arrest campaigns throughout the occupied territories, detaining dozens of Palestinians in raids across the occupied West Bank early Monday. The Palestinian Prisoner Society revealed that the arrests were made mainly in Ain al-Sultan camp in Ariha, also known as Jericho, and Al-Jalazon refugee camp in Ramallah, as well as in a number of villages west of the city. The society accused Israel of trying to find different excuses to raid Palestinian areas. This time, the Israeli army announced that its forces operating in the West Bank were exposed to fire more than once by Palestinian resistance fighters.
The reasons behind arresting Palestinians this time are many and different, and the goal is to drain the energy of the Palestinian people, in which they won't resist Israel, the occupation. The Israeli tries through detention to convince the people that there is no way to achieve victory.
Israeli forces continue to storm Palestinian villages and cities on a daily basis under the excuse of arresting Palestinian activists. In the village of Qatani, northwest occupied Al-Quds, two Palestinians were shot and seriously wounded before they were detained.
These campaigns are part of Israeli oppression that aims at breaking the Palestinian resistance to occupation, but they will not succeed. And in my opinion, all these arrests reflect the crisis of the Israeli system that does not understand that Palestinians will never give up.
Palestinians warn that Israel's escalated crackdown against the activists and the use of excessive force is meant to fight the Palestinian resistance. They see the operations as a failed attempt to intimidate the youth into giving up resistance. Israel holds thousands of Palestinians, including women and minors, in jail. Israel intensifies its arrest campaigns against Palestinians under the pretext of a policy known as mowing the lawn, which is aimed at re-arresting Palestinian activists to prevent any forms of resistance. Experts say these detentions remain as part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against the Palestinians. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
In honor of tens of athletes and sporting clubs, the Global Campaign to Return to Palestine held the International Forum to honor anti-normalization athletes under the slogan Al-Quds Golden Medal in the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
We are honoring these champions from Iran and different Arab countries because they refuse to play against an Israeli player because they don't recognize the so-called Israel. They paid a heavy price for that. We look at them as heroes.
Fathi Nourin, an Algerian and world champion who pulled out of four different competitions after finding out he would compete with an Israeli competitor, was punished by the International Judo Federation, which withdrew his Olympics accreditation. He noted that nothing is more significant than Palestine.
For us as athletes in Algeria, nothing is more valuable than the Palestinian cause, which is the cause of all Arabs and Muslims. And we are in solidarity with them and back them in any way we can. We have the chance to send a message to the world and raise awareness through sports about the Israeli terrorism, since the Israelis have been trying to win recognition through sports competitions, and we can through sports show the truth.
The athletes who were honored through their matches in international and regional tournaments to protest the presence of Israeli players or teams. Two chess players also had their share of a gold medal. So did 14-year-old Mauritanian Mohammed Abdulrahman.
There was like three people that qualified from Africa and I qualified. And during that tournament, it was the last round, I played against this Israeli guy. And I just didn't play since it's a common gesture and I stand with Palestine.
The Global Campaign to Return to Palestine stressed that they wanted to launch this initiative to show that these athletes who paid a price, whether being dismissed from international tournaments or deprived of important medals and valuable prizes, have won people's respect for their stance in defense of Palestine and the culture of resistance.
These athletes said they decided to rescind an international competition and prize if it meant recognizing Israeli occupation and apartheid state. Yet little did they know that by so doing, they became champions for millions of hearts across the Arab and Muslim worlds. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
What often passes for cultured Parisian cool has been exposed as deadly indifference to suffering humanity following the death of René Robert, a famous photographer of flamenco music. The 85-year-old fainted while on a walk in one of the most crowded areas of Paris. He couldn't get up and then tragically died of hypothermia after being ignored for 9 hours. The death has shocked France and has shamed the capital city in news worldwide. Robert died likely because people assumed he was just another street person in a fabulously rich city where homelessness is somehow a common sight. The person who finally checked on Robert was a homeless person who probably knew all too well the indifference of Paris to people sleeping rough, even in winter.
We keep repeating the same things. Everyone needs access to a life with dignity. We ask for structural reforms which will have real impact on the lives of people living in precarious existence. There has been a disengagement from France regarding the basic social minimums required in life.
Officially, around 6,000 people die on the streets of France each year, but NGOs say the real number is closer to 3,000 people. Refugees, mostly from countries hit by Western military intervention, die out of sight and without identification in tents, pushed into unseen and unlivable corners of the country.
We consider the question of housing to be a vital effort we need to make. We're asking for the basic recognition that everyone needs a roof over their heads. We're asking all the candidates in this spring's election to recognize that a state must take care of people.
Annual budget cuts during the age of austerity have pushed even more poor and mentally ill people into the streets, with evictions exploding so much the government refuses to publish the data anymore. Paris is the most population-dense city in the Western world, but government housing policy favors landlords and not renters. None of these government policy choices really explains the passing of René Robert, but many hope his needless death can change France's indifference towards the plight of those living on the streets. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Leading business owners, producers, and entrepreneurs were invited to a special place, Beit Rahbari. That's the official residence of Iran's leader. The meeting was aimed at allowing industrialists to share their concerns and highlight the major challenges they face in the production process with leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, listening and taking notes.
Your Highness, production is always associated with problems. If we want to produce, we need to brace for any possible problems. I dare say even the world's biggest entrepreneur, Mr. Bill Gates, could not manage a coffee shop under these difficult circumstances. But Iranian producers manage to run their businesses with all the foreign-imposed hardships.
Let's not sacrifice domestic production for imports. I proudly say that our biotech products have the capacity to be exported to other countries if the government lends its support.
At a time when the coronavirus pandemic led many countries to face shortage in medical supplies, Iran faced yet another problem, U.S. sanctions. But thanks to the efforts of our medical producers, we did not face any shortage in medical items during the pandemic.
We are fighting an economic war. We Iranian producers are the economic soldiers. So it's heartwarming when our leader lends his support for us. But it entails practical steps by authorities to make a change.
We got along with sanctions. We learned how to run our businesses despite the sanctions. The only thing we need to do is to modify our domestic regulations in favor of local producers.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed the efforts of Iranian economic operators.